welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are here on Thursday, October 5th, 2017, to talk about Week 5 of the NFL season. And joining me today to talk about routes is USA Today's Lindsay Jones. Lindsay, how are you?
I'm really excited for this hour-long All Route Tree podcast. It's going to be phenomenal.
The sad thing is I think I have like 2 minutes of route material, and then I think you would blow me away and that would be it, and I would just be embarrassed and have to quit.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's been a silly couple days here in sports media land with all of the Cam Newton stuff that has gone on. So yeah, we're all of us female journalists are having to stand there and, you know, defend our football knowledge to the trolls of the internet is it's never fun.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not this is not the first time this has happened either.
No, certainly not. I mean, I think you could probably talk to any woman who's been covering sports at any level, whether it's high school football or high school basketball through the NBA, the NFL. We've all experienced things like what happened to Jordan Rodriguez in Charlotte this week, where a football player, an athlete, a coach, whoever it might be, is dismissive of your question or of you in general because you're a woman. It's a kind of the casual sexism that I think exists in this industry where, you know, it might not be as blatant as saying something super personally offensive or the lazy, you know, oh, you should get back in the kitchen. But it's kind of the assumption of, oh, you didn't play in the NFL, you didn't play football, so there's no reason that you should be able to talk about it. Or I don't want to take you seriously because you're a woman, which it's kind of ridiculous because I think you could poll just about, you know, the majority of male sports writers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many of them played football, period, or how many of them played beyond high school, which I don't think playing high school football makes you some sort of expert beyond what anybody else is. So I'm sure you were all running these super innovative, creative offenses with these very complicated route trees, you know, in 1992 for your high school team. So,
yeah,
so anyways, that's kind of where I've stood on that. I mean, I just think kind of it's this misunderstanding of what a journalist's job is, whether you're covering football or politics or healthcare policy or, you know, crime, you know. Political reporters, most of them, they haven't served in Congress. They haven't worked in the White House. That doesn't disqualify them from covering the White House or covering Congress. What you do is you research, you report, you ask questions, and to make yourself somewhat of an expert. But you do a lot of reporting, and that's how you tell these stories. And that's strictly what she was doing. And Cam Newton dismissed her completely because she was a woman, and you know that's unacceptable.
Yeah, I mean that's this invisible sort of bar you guys have to hop over, which even though I'm someone who never played football and whatever knowledge I have is based on the same stuff you guys have done in terms of, you know, doing your job and researching and learning about the game and finding things out. You know, that's a bar I almost never have to encounter. No one ever really comes to me and says, oh, did you play the game? Because it's just assumed that I have some level of credibility just because I could feasibly, theoretically have played football at some level, even though I'm an incredibly bad athlete. And so many women in the industry would be better at playing football than I would be.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it's not just in a locker room or at a press conference setting where you have to kind of prove yourself and the work, the background work that you've done and the research and all of that stuff. I mean, it happens anywhere you're at. If you're sitting at a sports bar or on an airplane or waiting, you know, you're talking to your dentist between your cleanings and they find out what you do. You have to spend a lot of time just trying to prove that you know what you're talking about. And, you know, you just have to work extra hard at it and just kind of be ready that people are going to not want to hear it sometimes from a woman. I mean, I had a colleague in Denver. I mean, I guess somebody who works in this market tell me a couple years ago, I don't mind reading women who write sports. I just can't listen to them talk about it, which was so personally, I mean, it was just so offensive because I couldn't even wrap my head around it because you could read it, but you can't listen to it. You don't want to hear a woman's voice talking about football. I mean, it's just this level of sexism that's so ingrained kind of in this business, but you know, we deal with it. I hope this can be a learning experience both for Cam Newton and for a lot of other guys in the league. And for people who consume sports media, I hope it is. I mean, I think the discourse in this country is not really at a state right now where everybody wants to listen to each other, but sure. Hopefully some good will come out of this and people will have maybe learned a little bit.
Hopefully. And yeah, I mean, the argument that, you know, you have to have played the game. It seems like it doesn't apply, like you said, to any other industries. It's not as if you go into a restaurant and order a steak and the steak tastes bad. And so you say, hey, the steak tastes bad. And the chef comes out and says, well, you didn't go to culinary school, so you can't tell me if this steak tastes bad. Like, no, you've eaten steak. You've seen other people eat steak. You know what steak's supposed to taste like. If it doesn't taste like that, you know it's bad. It doesn't. I don't know why it's pervasive in sports more so than it is in other industries.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. But yeah, it's just something that we have to deal with all the time. And I know male reporters get it from time to time, too. It's probably the easiest, most lazy way that athletes and coaches can be dismissive of mm-hmm. reporters is to say, well, you don't understand. You've never played or you didn't do this. But we're here researching. We're asking questions. We're wanting to have these conversations. We're watching film. We're going into deep analytics and all of these things. So mm-hmm. it's just kind of a lazy excuse to want to be dismissive of the media by saying, oh, you didn't play. And that's an argument that doesn't carry a ton of weight with me.
It doesn't. And I mean, it wasn't like Jordan's, you know, question was something where she was saying, hey, you know, you guys are wrong. I know more than you about football. She was asking a question where, you know, the answer would have been, it would have revealed something. It would have explained something about football that would not be perhaps obvious to the public at hand. And it wasn't like it was a question that would have been too jargonistic or too complicated for the broader public. Like, it was a reasonable, valid question. It was a question that was going to reveal something about the game. So that's why it's even more infuriating from Cam Newton's perspective, where it's just like, nobody was challenging you. Like, there was no reason to be defensive and weird about it. And it was just so unnecessarily shitty of him to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that she's a beat writer, so she's been there every day she's been at that paper for about a year. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of female beat writers around the country, you know, cover the Broncos and the Jets and the Browns, who are there every day. So it's not like this was the first time that Cam Newton had seen her. She's mm-hmm. probably asked him 100 questions over the last year, probably nearly all of them dealing some manner with football, asking about specific plays and specific routes. So the mm-hmm. fact that he decided to be dismissive, I mean, I got a lot of people sending me things yesterday saying it sounded like he was just really surprised and impressed that she knew about football. No, that's BS. She's been there every day. She's asking these questions every day. He's just being a jerk.
Yeah,
that's all
him,
there is to
for
it.
For him to pretend afterwards that he did not know her, like, come on. Like, that's just unrealistic. I just don't, I don't get how you can do that credibly and think to yourself, oh, this is going to get me out of the situation. This is a logical, reasonable way to approach the situation. It was embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a huge media market. There's not that many reporters who are at the Panthers facility on a day-to-day basis. So the fact that he didn't know her name just showed that he didn't want to know her name and didn't really have any interest in knowing the people who are there. And I've covered quarterbacks who are like that. When Jay Cutler was with the Broncos, he wanted nothing to do with any of the reporters there. Mm-hmm. On my first day at work, their head PR guy tried to introduce him to me, and he just blew right past us, didn't even look at either of us. I mean, the Patrick Smythe tried to step in and just introduce. He had zero interest. And then, you know, that's at one end of the spectrum. And then there's, you know, Peyton Manning, who introduces himself to every single person and wants to know their name. And Kirk Cousins has a roster with headshots of all of the Washington beat reporters in his locker, so he knows who people are. It's just a matter of how you want to approach it. And if you want to have, look, we're not trying to be friends. We don't need to have a friendly relationship by any means, but there just needs to be a manner of professionalism and respect that goes both ways.
Yeah, for sure. And there was no disrespect from Jordan's element of it, so it's hard to believe that Cam would be so disrespectful in response. But yeah, not a fun situation to deal with, and something I don't envy you guys who are on beats and who are covering teams on a day-to-day basis in the slightest, male or female. I could not do that job in a million years from my perch running numbers here in Brooklyn. It's unfathomable to me the idea that you guys can do that and do that well on a daily basis.
Well, and I will say the vast majority of players, coaches, media members that I deal with on a day-to-day basis and have for the last 10 years are nothing but professional, and gender is not usually an issue. I mean, you get the those the sort of you didn't play type of responses from time to time. I mean, I think the most heinous stuff that you get is on the internet. Mm-hmm. It's from Twitter. It's on Facebook. It's all of those sorts of things. I think the vast majority of people in the league are extremely professional and appreciate people who want to learn more about football, who want to have in-depth conversations, who want to gain knowledge from them. I mean, I think I've actually found sometimes that the people, the journalists that turn players and coaches and stuff off more are the people who go in being like, I'm the expert. I'm going to show off all of my knowledge that I have, mm-hmm. and I want you to validate me. I think that they appreciate more when you come in and say, hey, let's talk about this play exactly. Show me how it developed, why it developed, what was the thinking behind the play call, why did you use it in this situation, you know, why did this route work versus a different route, those sorts mm-hmm. of things. I think they tend to appreciate that a lot, and the fact that that was really what Jordan was trying to do in that situation with Cam, and he dismissed it. That was disappointing. But I think that's generally an outlier, and most people in the league would actually really engage with a question like that. That was, yeah, really, it was really a chance to kind of talk about a teammate and to talk about some kind of different type of football stuff that they don't really get to get into all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So anything else? I feel like we were going to talk about this for a minute, and then we got into a more useful conversation about it. But we do have other football games to
get to. Yeah, let's talk about football. Let's do this.
Let's have a knowledgeable football conversation ourselves here. Let's get to four games this week. And one that you're going to be covering this week is the most surprising team in football, I think I would say, the Los Angeles Rams, who are playing the Seattle Seahawks, a team that they have been victimizing in years past with unlikely victories. Seemingly every game has a fake punt where the Rams managed to trick the favored Seahawks. But this week, the Rams, surprisingly, are favored to beat the Seahawks. Do you think that is a fair line? It's a one-point line, so it's not like it's a big difference. Basically, that they're perceived to be competitive with the Seahawks after the first four games of this season.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with them, right? They're scoring mm-hmm. 35 points a game. Jared Goff's been playing really well. He's not turning over the football. They've got the talent on defense. Mm-hmm. I think if this game was in Seattle, that line would look different.
Yeah, for sure.
For sure. I mean, it might be 3 or 4 points the other way, if not more than that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think the Seahawks were given as much credit for their week 3 win as the Rams were. I mean, the Seahawks beat the crap out of the Colts. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people probably stopped watching that game in the second half when Fair. They really just pulled away. And I don't know how much of that it was just the Colts or how much it was the Seahawks finally getting their stuff together on offense. Mm-hmm. But I think the Rams certainly deserve the credit that they're getting right now. I mean, if you go back and watch their games of the first 4 weeks, this isn't a fluke. You know, they're not scoring in gimmicky ways. They're not, you know, this isn't by accident. They're playing really well. This offense that Sean McVay has installed is working better than anybody could have imagined that it would work this quickly. I mean, I think I'm not entirely surprised that his scheme works because mm-hmm. we've seen it work in Washington. He had great success with Kirk Cousins. Mm-hmm. What I've been surprised by is with how many changes they had on that entire offensive roster, overhauling the wide receiving core, bringing in all those new pieces with mm-hmm. Robert Woods and Sammy Watkins coming in really late, Cooper Kupp, a rookie slot receiver, which is a really hard position to play as a rookie mm-hmm. And to play it well. All the changes they had on the offensive line with a new center, a new left tackle. And then not to mention Jared Goff, who really didn't have very much experience last year. It's hard to even give him too much credit as a starting experience playing in that really limited offense mm-hmm. and on such a bad team that they were last year. You know, with all of those questions, it's really come together very, very quickly. And that's what's really surprised me the most, that these changes are working so quickly.
Yeah, it does seem like you think about, I was talking with the Kai of Nesson on the Nickel Package on Wednesday about the Patriots. And he said, yeah, you know, if you take Bill Belichick to the side, he would say, oh, well, September, you know, that's really the new preseason because that's the first time you're really practicing. You're really working with your guys on a week to week basis. And it just takes some time for you to get, you know, your stuff together. And it looks like this has been a Rams team that's been playing together for 5 years now in terms of this offense where everyone's in stride. There's so many passes that are, you know, the plays that are working so smoothly that it's not like it's not Todd Gurley making five guys miss and jumping over everyone. Like, you will jump over a guy here or there, but there are so many plays where it's just a screen to Gurley called at the perfect time where they have three blockers set up and it's the right call in the right situation. And, you know, I don't know if it's McVay's play calling. I don't know if it's Jared Goff checking the things or seeing things before the play starts. But there's just so many plays where it looks like this offense is working at such a high level. And you think about the fact is, yeah, they did start 3-1 last year. But that was three games where they beat Seattle 9-3, they beat Tampa 37-32, and they beat Arizona 17-13. So three really close victories. And this year, yeah, granted, they had the close win over the 49ers, and a really exciting back-and-forth game, but they were ahead for most of that game. It was kind of a late spurt for the Niners to push things close. Blew out the Colts, and Colts stink, but you still blew them out. They did what you were supposed to do. And then beating the Cowboys in Dallas last week, even if it was just by 5 points, was, you know, probably one of the biggest wins for this franchise outside of the Seahawks games in years. I mean, it was a real statement victory and a real example of, you know, what a real statement of what they are capable of doing if everything goes right. And if they can beat the Seahawks here, if they're 4-1, they're two games ahead of the Seahawks in the divisional picture and have the tiebreaker, and have beat the Cowboys and Seahawks in consecutive weeks, I mean, I think that's the point where I would start thinking fundamentally differently about this team and their expectations for 2017 versus even, you know, maybe the best expectations I had for them heading into the season.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they deserve a lot of credit for going into Dallas and winning last week, but the defense that they played last week in Dallas with the Cowboys when they didn't have Sean Lee, they were very thin at linebacker, so that makes things a little bit easier for Todd Gurley, obviously. It's just a lot different than the defense that they're going to be facing with the Seahawks right now. And yes, the Seahawks have had their issues over the start of the season, but it's been hard to criticize a lot that they've been doing defensively, at least. So this is going to be the biggest challenge that they've had so far this year. And yeah, if they can, I mean, look, I'm not expecting them to put up 35 points like they have been so far this season, but if they can win this game, if it's a close, you know, if it's a 27-24 final field goal type of situation, I think that would also make me think differently about the Rams, just maybe take them a little bit more seriously. But it's been really fun to watch them over the first couple weeks, and I will admit I was really surprised that it has come together this quickly.
Oh, for sure. I don't think even your most dyed-in-the-wool optimistic Rams fan would have expected them to be this good, averaging 35.5 points per game through 4 weeks. That would have been crazy.
They've been getting some good defensive performances in there. I think, was it week one where they had a couple pick sixes?
Yeah.
I mean, they've been getting contributions from other scoring from defense as well. But to put up 35 points a game over 4 weeks, that's really special. That's really impressive.
Yeah, it's really hard to pull off, even over a four-week stretch where you think, okay, well, it's just 4 games, but there's just not a lot of teams who can pull that off over a 4-game stretch. I will say, the one thing I'd be worried about with the Rams, their weakness so far, I would say, has been their rush defense. They're 24th in the league in DVOA against the run. So you would figure, okay, maybe that's a place the Seahawks can make some hay, keep the Rams offense off the field, keep their defense fresh, which has been a problem in games. The problem is, I don't know who's even going to run the football for the Seahawks. Chris Carson, of course, suffered an injury last week. He is done for the season. So now is it Thomas Rawls? Is it A. Lacy? Is it J.D. McKissick, who looked good at the stretches last week? C.J. Procise looks like he's probably not going to be healthy enough to play. But do you think there is a plan for the Seahawks, or is it kind of just going to be, you know, just whoever gets hot, whoever seems to develop some sort of rhythm is who Pete Carroll might choose to go to in this game?
Yeah, and I think that's what we've seen from them over the last couple of years, where it just seems like they're constantly dealing with injuries at running back, dating back a couple of years when Marshawn Lynch was still there and he got hurt. If there's any trend, I will say I've been at multiple games live over the last couple of years when Thomas Rawls has just had a monster game. Mm-hmm. So if it has anything to do with me going to L.A. this weekend, put Thomas Rawls on your fantasy team, because I swear he only has his like ridiculous. He had like a monster game in Cincinnati a couple of years ago. I think it was his first start. And then last year, I believe it was the game against the Panthers.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember in Seattle, early December. Done this a lot where they just kind of have to figure out who's going to be the guy. Yeah. I mean, J.D. McKissick, is it going to be Eddie Lacy, who's been very much a disappointment so far? That move just hasn't really worked out at all. But I will say, you know, I guess the good news for them in losing Chris Carson right now is that they're not unfamiliar with this. They are very used to having to bring in different guys and kind of just go with the hot hand and see who that's going to be. So, you know, I like Thomas Rawls when he's healthy. He's mm-hmm. been kind of explosive there. He's very much like a kind of a mini beast mode style, really tough between the tackles kind of runner. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe it's going to be his week. We'll see, but that's a big question. I mean, I think those issues are not going to go away all year for the Seahawks, just like the offensive line issues aren't ever going to fully go away.
No, not until Tom Cable leaves. Not until then. Maybe there's a shot the offensive line problems will go away. Let me finish up with this, and then I'm going to ask you for your prediction for this game. I wrote about the possible award candidates through 4 weeks heading into the season for ESPN today, and I struggle with this question. I want to know what you think. Who do you think from the Rams, and this is strange to say, but it is, I think, a fair question to ask, who is the better MVP candidate through 4 games? Is it Jared Goff or is it Todd Gurley?
Ooh. Well, so we do at USA Today, we do MVP rankings mm-hmm. week by week, and I put Todd Gurley in my top three this week. So, you know, I just think the amount of touchdowns that Todd Gurley has been scoring, the things mm-hmm. that he's been doing to open up that offense. So right now I'd say Todd Gurley, but if Goff can keep this up, keep mm-hmm. up this, you know, not turning the ball over, you know, making really smart decisions, then God, I can't even, like, it makes my head hurt thinking, even saying the sentence that we'd talk about Jared Goff in an MVP consideration.
Right.
But yeah, right now I'd say Gurley, but it's definitely an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
One I would not expect to have been having.
I would not either. I said Gurley as well, just because I can't, as good as Goff's been, just so they've relied so heavily on Gurley, especially as a touchdown machine, given that he has 7, I think, of their 11 touchdowns. And then even in that Thursday night game, they kept trying to give him the ball inside the 5-yard line to get him to 4 and 5 touchdowns in that game before going elsewhere. It just seems like, you know, I can't fathom, even given what I've seen from Goff, this offense being anywhere near as effective without Todd Gurley as the focal point of the offense. They just would not be able to run it with Lance Dunbar or whoever else they would have in a secondary role if healthy behind Gurley. So I went with Gurley, but yeah, I don't know what the answer is. And I can ask you the same question, actually, about our next game. Actually, no, before we get to that, do you have a prediction for this game?
So I picked the Seahawks to win this game. I don't feel super confident about it. I also picked it to be a fairly low-scoring game. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, would kind of go against all these things we've been talking about this high-scoring Rams offense. But I think if the Rams are going to come down a little bit, if this offense is going to kind of have a tough game, this, I think, is going to be when it's going to happen, just with what Richard Sherman and Earl Thomas and those guys have done to young quarterbacks in the past. I think that's why I went ahead and picked the Seahawks in this game. In the paper, I picked them 17-14. Win this game, but like I said, I don't feel super, super confident about it. I've picked against the Rams multiple times already this year, so I also wouldn't be shocked if it, you know, winds up a, you know, 28-24, 31-28 type of more high scoring game than what I've initially predicted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree. I will say, interesting thing for me in this game, the Rams have the leads most yards after catch per play in terms of. On a per-catch basis, they average more yards after catch than anyone in the league. Seahawks, over the last 5 years, though, number one in the league against yards after catch in terms of preventing them. So I guess it's a question of whether it's the classic Legion of Boom and it's the guys who are making plays, wrapping up, making tackles, or if the Rams can be the exception to the rule there. Chiefs-Texans, next game let's get to. Two playoff contenders in the AFC, and I can ask you the same question about the Chiefs. Who is the more viable MVP candidate through 4 weeks? Is it Alex Smith or is it Kareem Hunt?
Yeah, so I've mentioned our MVP rankings. I've had Alex Smith at the top of those rankings, I guess, 4 weeks in a row now.
Really?
And, I mean, statistically, I mean, he's not passing for, you know, 400 yards a game or, you know, anything insane like that. Mm-hmm. But the combination of his passing, he's going downfield a lot more. His mobility, the way that he's just operating what's the most interesting, creative offense in the NFL right now, that's why I have Alex Smith there. That is not to take anything away from Kareem Hunt, because you just watch this kid from play to play, and you just have to be amazed. Like, he's very special. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, it's not just that he's... It's not a schematic thing necessarily, although he is kind of the perfect type of back for what Andy Reid wants to do, just given, how good he's been in the passing game so far. But yeah, I just think Alex Smith right now, he's just playing at a level he's never played at before. He's doing things that are, you know, very interesting. He's not game managing. And you know, I think it's almost offensive at this point to call Alex Smith a game manager. And I know people keep wanting to do it. I mean, I wrote about this after the Monday Night Football game, where his post-game press conference is actually really funny, because every question he got asked almost was basically a backhanded compliment about old Alex. You know, it was like, well, you guys used to never be able to score the game-winning points on the game-winning drive. You could never come up with that. And you you showed some toughness, and we have never really seen that before. And, oh, people, critics will say, you know, when Alex Smith runs, he doesn't look downfield. And Alex is just saying, like, shaking his head. And he's like, oh, they're saying I'm soft. I mean, it was really he was very self-deprecating about it. But we just have this opinion formed over, what, 10 years now of what Alex Smith should be as a quarterback. And that doesn't really jive with what we're seeing on a week-to-week basis with the Chiefs offense. I mean, he's right now playing better than any quarterback in the league when you take everything together as a whole, passing game, managing the offense, what he's doing with his legs, the way he's able to scramble. I think he had 56 rushing yards against Washington on Monday night. I mean, important yards as well. So that's why I've got Alex Smith up at the top right now. But man, Kareem Hunt is really, really special.
I mean, they're intertwined. I think I picked Hunt, but it's so unfair to pick one or the other, I think, just because, you know, they're helping each other. You know, in terms of Alex Smith being able to throw downfield, a lot of that is just teams are terrified of Kareem Hunt. And so they have extra guys in the box there. You know, they have guys looking into the backfield, trying to see what's happening with the, you know, with the option attack, with Alex Smith, you know, motioning, and then you have Tyreek Hill, you know, creating havoc moving across the formation. I mean, there's so many different things you have to account for at the snap and in the first seconds of the play that, you know, you're not necessarily focused on your coverage responsibilities, and that's creating opportunities for Alex Smith to throw downfield. And then I think the flip side of that is that teams are concerned about Alex Smith as a runner and have been for a few years now, but this is, I think, the biggest example of that with the Chiefs, where, you know, he is such a functional part of that rushing attack that teams have to account for him. They can't crash in and worry about Kareem Hunt, because Alex Smith is going to keep and run outside on the zone read and make plays, or it's totally viable for him to, you know, bootleg out and make a play on his feet. Like, there's so many things he can do that, even if he is limited, even if he's not necessarily going to be Brett Favre in terms of chucking the ball downfield, like, he can still beat teams so many different ways that I think he is a really valuable player, and someone who, as good as he's been this year, and as much as he's looked different and improved in ways this year, I do think we were probably also underrating him in years past, given how effective he'd been for Andy Reid, excuse me.
I agree. I think I've probably been higher on Alex Smith than a lot of people. I remember there were a couple games over the last, I mean, look, the Chiefs have been a really good team for several years, and maybe we just haven't given them quite the credit they deserve because they haven't translated that regular season success into the postseason. But Alex Smith has been playing pretty well, I mean, for years now, really, ever since he got to Kansas City. And we just now maybe are finally noticing it because of the wins that they've had, some of the high profile, you know, going into Foxborough, kind of elevated this whole thing, the way that they played against the Patriots and then the way that they've been playing late in games. I think that's probably been the underrated part of how the Chiefs have been winning so far, and to be the last undefeated team, is that they've scored 44 points in the fourth quarter of games this year. Obviously that includes the 6 points with zero seconds remaining on the clock with the crazy Justin Houston return touchdown, the most ridiculous way to cover a football game that I've ever seen live. That includes that, but they've been really good in the fourth quarter. Kareem Hunt has been really good to close out games, and that's so valuable right now, that if they're going to be in close games or if they're going to be leading games, to have a running back who's going to only get better as the game goes on, they're going to be able to extend leads or close out games in ways that most teams around the league cannot do.
So let me make this point now that we just spent 5 minutes glowing about how good Alex Smith and Kareem Hunt and the Chiefs offense have been. This could be a bad matchup for them. I really believe this could give them a lot of trouble. And the reason why is I'm concerned about the offensive line, which, when healthy, one of the best lines in football. I think Andy Reid and Andy Hack do a great job of coaching up that line. But a lot of injury concerns. They could be out all three of the guys they would have expected to start on the interior of their offensive line against the Texans on Sunday. It's Parker Ehringer, Mitch Morris, and Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. Aaron Judge's been hurt all year. Morse has been out since week two against the Eagles. DuVernay already got hurt against Washington. Eric Fisher, their starting left tackle, has a back injury, and it was honestly kind of a surprise he was able to suit up against Washington. So you can only account for so many injuries up front before it becomes a problem. And there were stretches in the Washington game where Washington was just eating their offense up because they were getting guys into the backfield. They were giving Smith trouble. They were making plays. The Chiefs actually seemed to adjust and do a pretty good job of accounting for it in the second half, but there's just not, you can't have a talented, you know, you can't have three talented swing linemen playing in reserve. You're going to have trouble. You're going to have hiccups. And I think, given that they're facing JJ Watt and a bunch of other really talented front seven pieces, I think this could be a game where the Texans give them fits with their offensive line.
Oh, absolutely. And I think Alex Smith has been sacked more than, I think, only one other quarterback. I mean, he's the second most sacked guy through 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong on that stat. But yeah, I mean, he's been under a lot of pressure, and he was under constant pressure. I mean, the Washington front four dominated the first half of that game, just like they did the week before against the Raiders. Yeah. I mean, they had a great game plan. They were very technically sound. They were just consistently rushing four. It wasn't like they were, you know, beating the Chiefs up front with crazy stunts and blitzes or anything. I mean, they were just winning up front with four guys. And, you know, Ryan Kerrigan's very good player and stuff. But I think if you want to talk about like sheer talent that the Texans are going to line up, you know, J.J. Watt, Jadeveon Clowney, I mean, those are even better players. So, yeah, if you're the Chiefs right now, I'm very concerned about that matchup, both what they can do in a pass rush to get after Alex Smith, but also what sort of things they might be able to do in defending the run as well.
Yeah, and they could be in a lot of, you know, a lot of second and long, third and long situations if there's penalties, and they do have some issues with penalties. Brian Witzman, who has been filling in on the offensive line, has six penalties in 4 weeks. It's more than, tied for the league lead, I think it's more than any other offensive player in football. They have Jordan Devey coming in, who wasn't good against Washington. It was a guy who made Tom Brady look bad in that famous game against the Chiefs a few years ago. And then the next guy up is Cam Irving, who wasn't good enough for the Browns. The Browns traded him away after he couldn't make their offensive line. So are some issues there. And on the other side of the ball, I think there's another concern about penalties, because the Chiefs are second in the league against defensive penalties, and they're facing a team that has forced a ton of pass interference and holding calls this year, and the Texans, who DeAndre Hopkins has seven pass interference penalties drawn this year. Nobody else in the
league
has more. Yeah, no one else has more than three. He has seven through four games. So it is masking some of the, you know, of his performance, but it's just teams are really worried about Hopkins, and he's getting force-fed the ball like nobody's business right now from Deshaun Watson.
Yeah, and when Watson extends plays the way that he does, I think that also contributes, right, to those pass interference penalties, because, you know, while Marcus Peters is a very good corner, he had a bad game on Monday night against Washington. There's no question about that. But even when you have one of those better corners, when Deshaun Watson is running around and extending plays and bootlegging out, there's only so long you can cover before you really have to start holding a guy and interfering. And I would imagine that we'll see, you know, a couple more of those big pass interference plays in this game on Sunday.
Yeah, it's hardly out of the question. And Marcus Peters has been, you know, he's always going to make plays. He's always going to challenge for interceptions. And that can be a thing with Watson, given that Watson has thrown four picks and 114 tries so far this season. But, I mean, the Chiefs have been allowing 86.7 yards per game to number one receivers. That's sixth most in the league. 24th in DVOA to number one receivers. They're number one in the league to number twos. But this is a team that is so heavy, so heavily predicated upon targeting Hopkins. And last time they played, when Peters was in the lineup, DeAndre Hopkins had Brock Osweiler as his quarterback and still had seven catches for 113 yards and a touchdown. So I would be.
I didn't know those two actually even knew each other. I'm stunned to hear that. And now it looks like the Texans, you said that the Chiefs have had success against number two receivers, but now the Texans actually have kind of a number two receiver now that Fuller's back. He had a really good game. I mean, everybody had a good game for the Texans last week against the Titans. I mean, I think the long snapper had an excellent game, the water boys. But but now it's more than just Hopkins. And now that Fuller's back and healthy, I think that's going to give defenses even more trouble, because you're going to, if you want to devote everything you got to DeAndre Hopkins, then you might pay for it.
Yeah, for sure. It's hardly out of the question. And I don't know. I feel like I'm being too negative on the Chiefs. I do think they're probably still going to win this game. I want to hear what you think, but I do, I, it would not surprise me in the way that maybe some other teams would surprise me in beating the Chiefs. I do think the Texans are perhaps uniquely a bad matchup for the Chiefs in some ways.
Yeah, and I want to see Deshaun Watson kind of perform like this consistently. It's just how it always is with young quarterbacks where, you know, you can have one or two big games and then defenses will catch up to you. I mean, Bob Sutton is one of the best technical defensive coordinators of the league in Kansas City. You know, so maybe they'll be very well coached to the things that Deshaun Watson has already been doing. I did pick the Chiefs to win this game. I'm actually looking, our entire staff picked the Chiefs to win this game, which I'm surprised about. That's probably a bad sign that we all picked the Chiefs. You know, I've been impressed, like I mentioned, the way that the Chiefs have managed to win their games. They're playing really well late in games. I think the experience will ultimately pay out that they have. The experience that they have at quarterback will ultimately kind of come to play in this game. And, you know, if Kareem Hunt can have a big fourth quarter like he's already been having. But, yeah, it suddenly became a really, really interesting game. I would not have said this a couple weeks ago that the Texans would be kind of a game to watch. But Deshaun Watson has made them super exciting, and I'm looking forward to watching probably every minute of it.
It's such a more fun experience with Deshaun Watson than it was with Tom Savage. It's
what were they doing all summer? I mean, I'm watching this game last week, and they're doing so many creative things. They're running option plays. They're just getting him on the move a lot, and you can just tell that this offense is kind of energized and excited, and they're making up for the deficiencies that they have on the offensive line. And it's just like, what were you doing all summer with this Tom Savage thing? Like, how much further advanced could they be right now if they would have made this either an open competition or done the right thing and made Watson the starter from – you know, maybe the first or second week of August instead of waiting until halftime of week one.
It does raise some questions. At some point in the next few weeks, they're going to take credit for, oh, we found a franchise quarterback. We're so smart. We traded up. We grabbed our guy. And it's like, you're the same people who thought Brock Osweiler was worth $16 million a year. And you also thought Tom Savage was a better quarterback in week one and still put him out there. So I'm skeptical that you really have all that much insight into what makes a good quarterback, and more just you kept firing shots until you actually found someone who was good and then were happily and pretended that you had made the right decision all along. There's another team like that who might come into play, but we're going to get to them in their game in a minute after the break. We'll have more Bill Barnwell Show coming in a moment. But first, guys, I've got some interesting facts for you here from the folks at Gillette. Did you know the tip of a Gillette razor blade is measured on an atomic scale? It means their blade edges are thinner than a single brain cell. And that precision, well, that's the work of many brain cells. The hundreds of members of Gillette's research and development team have spent over 4,700 years combined, working to make your shave closer and more comfortable. That's longer than the Egyptian pyramids have been around. And while over 1,000 craftsmen and women in Boston are busy making your blades, another team is putting your blades through more than 60 extremely strict and precise quality checks. Fail just one of these tests, and it does not leave the factory. In other words, the hardworking people at Gillette never stop working to make your blades better. And now, that includes the price tag, because you can get Gillette blades at their lowest prices in years. See for yourself at GilletteOnDemand.com. Gillette, the best a man can get. Pricing applies to select products and is at the sole discretion of the retailer. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined by Lindsay Jones of USA Today, and we're talking about Week 5 of the NFL season. Let's get to another team that's making a quarterback change, the Chicago Bears, who are playing the Minnesota Vikings on Monday Night Football and starting Mitch Trubisky for his first NFL appearance. So, Lindsay, let me ask you, before we know what's going to happen, because I think it'll be obvious after the fact, but in advance, given what we know right now, do you think this was the right time to make a change, given that they had the long week after that Thursday night game against the Packers? Or was it a bad idea to start him in prime time against a very talented and very ferocious, in some ways, Vikings front seven?
Well, I mean, I think it's better to start them to make the change now while they have a couple extra days to prepare than having to do it on maybe a regular week or a short week or switching him into the starting lineup in the middle of the game, middle of a game where you just get to the point where you have to pull the plug on the Mike Glennon experience. I'm trying to look at their schedule here to see when else maybe you could have done it.
They don't have a bye for a while, so it wasn't like they were going to wait until midseason.
Yeah, their bye is really late. So otherwise, I mean, you're kind of doing it midweek, you know, in the middle of the season where you really have to do it on a short week. Mm-hmm. I will say, if you look back at John Fox's history, other times that he's had to make moves like this, he's done it on a bye week or a, this was basically a bonus bye week where they played Thursday night and then not again till Monday night. So this, the timing of it really made sense. You know, I don't know if there was ever going to be a really easy time to do it. I mean, I guess if you didn't do it this week, then it's, you know, he's going to make his first start on the road at the Ravens or against the Panthers or, you know, at the Superdome against the Saints or, you know, against the Packers. You know, I don't know if there was ever going to be a good time to do it. I think it was clear by now that Mike Glennon was not working out. You can talk about all the other issues that they had on offense, which of which there are many. That that wide receiver core is not great. Their offensive line has had issues. The entire team has struggled, which is one of the things that John Fox keeps saying over and over and over again, that it's more than just one player. But there's only one player who affects the game every play, and Mike Glennon, way too many turnovers. I don't think anybody around him was inspired by the level of play, and at some point you just have to make the change. And the time was right. I mean, I don't know if it's going to ultimately be the right decision, if Mitch Trubisky was ultimately ready or not, but you keep going this way with Mike Glennon, and pretty soon you're going to be looking at, you know, what, 1-7, 1-8 type of situation. And by then the entire season is gone.
The entire season's gone with a coaching staff that I think it's fair to say, I can't say I'm 100% sure, but I feel quite confident that they would get fired if they end up having another 4-12 season this year. So I think at some point it's just the coaches are doing it to save their jobs. I mean, not in a way to incur the moral hazard consciously, but perhaps unconsciously, just, you know they have to be competitive this year, more competitive than they've been in years past. And they've had bright spots. I mean, they could have beat the Falcons in week one. Certainly they beat the Steelers in week three. But two of the games on the road, they haven't been competitive. They got blown up by the Bucs. They didn't look good against the Packers. I think it was going to come early in the season in most cases. And the thing that I wonder about is just, I'm reading reports this week, Mitchell Trubisky, you know, he's really poised. He's really ready. It's the right time. We know what we're doing. And it's like, you guys also gave Mike Glennon $15 million a year and thought he was a franchise quarterback. And now after four games, you're like, you know, actually we're good. We were wrong. And it's good that you have Trubisky. It's good that you drafted a guy and traded up for somebody, I guess. But it also kind of begs the question of, do the Bears have any idea what they're doing?
I don't know the answer to that question. I do know, knowing John Fox and having covered him for as long as I have, I'm sure this decision was very painful to him. He's never been a guy who's wanted to play a young quarterback by any means. He will stick with the veteran guy for as long as possible until there's no other choice. I wouldn't honestly be shocked. He would never say anything like this, but if there's a little bit of, you guys want me to play the rookie? Well, if he sucks, then it'll be like, and I told you so, that he wasn't ready and that we should have stuck with this other guy. I don't know if he would ever say anything like that. I think that may have been the case back in 2011 when they finally had to pull the plug on the Kyle Orton situation and play Tebow. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody thought that he was going to be really bad and they were going to put themselves in position to get Andrew Luck. But then, I don't know, Jesus Christ intervened. We all saw what happened there. But, you know, yeah, I don't know if they know what they're doing. I think they've lucked into a great situation with Tariq Cohen. They need to use him better. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the best help to Trubisky, is if they can actually come up with some sort of consistent running game and, you know, not abandon it quickly, because you don't want to get in a situation where all of a sudden Trubisky's having to, you're falling behind early and Trubisky's having to pass the ball 40 times a game on Monday Absolutely. Night Football against the Vikings. That's just a terrible situation for everybody involved. So the team is going to have to play better. They're going to have to coach better. But in terms of timing, I think he had to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I think that I have issues with how they got to this point, but I think now that they're at this point, I don't think it's the worst idea necessarily. And I agree. I mean, I think for whatever Trubisky is or isn't going to be, he's not going to be Tom Brady from the jump. He's not going to be a superstar quarterback from day one. He's also probably not going to be the worst quarterback in the history of football from day one. So I think it's going to be more about what they can do to make his life easier. There is a good offensive line there, especially on the interior. The running back situation obviously is very sound. They have two really good running backs in Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen. The receiver is pretty bad. I'm not going to lie. It's a pretty awful receiving core. But you would hope that they're going to be able to run the ball effectively. They're going to keep Trubisky, like you said, out of those 45, 50 pass games. If they can keep him out of third and long in situations where, especially with the Vikings coming to town, it's going to be a really great pass rush. That would be nice. But the Vikings also have the league's eighth best run defense by DVOA. So as much as I think that's going to be the game plan going forward, I don't know that that's necessarily going to work this week just because the Vikings are so good against what the Bears are going to try and do.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm not giving the Bears a huge chance to win this game. It looks like it's going to be another week though with Case Keenum, which is always a roller coaster. I think if you're going to pick the Vikings in this game, like I am, I think you do it because of that defense. Because then if you want to match up, even if Case Keenum is going to be on a roller coaster up and down week to week, I think the game 2 weeks ago against the Bucks, that was certainly an outlier. If you look at Case Keenum's career, I think we're not going to see those type of huge passing performances from him on a week-to-week basis, but the offensive pieces around them are good. I'm curious to see how they make up for the loss of Dalvin Cook. Can Latavius Murray be their lead back? I mean, I really liked Latavius Murray over the last couple of years in Oakland, so maybe I'm a little bit higher on him than other people might be. That's not to say it's not a big loss to lose Dalvin Cook, because he had been playing really, really well in his rookie year. But, you know, I just think when you look at how talented the rosters are on both sides, I just don't see any way that the Bears can be really competitive in this game in Mitchell Trubisky's first start.
Yeah. It's interesting with Latavius Murray, because he's been on such a roller coaster so far this season where, you know, he played in week one, he fumbled. Dalvin Cook took over the job. Week two, week three, he's really out of the rotation. I think he only played a handful of snaps, maybe three or four snaps in one of those games. Where he was basically the third string guy behind, behind Jerick McKinnon and behind Dalvin Cook, and he was really playing a very small role. And so now he's back as basically the feature back. And so I'm intrigued to see if he feels like he has something to prove with the Vikings against against a division rival in a game where the Vikings would really like to come away with a win. One more question on this game, and then we'll move on to our final one. I don't know the answer to this, and I'm intrigued to hear what you think. This is kind of a hard question to phrase, but how many games do you think it has to be before Stephon Diggs, who right now leads the league in receiving yards, goes from being on the cusp of a breakout season to being actually in his breakout season?
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really ever thought of it like that. Yeah, hasn't he kind of been on the verge of being a breakout season for years now?
Yeah, for the last 2 years now.
And are we not considering him to be kind of in that upper echelon of receivers because of the revolving door that they've had at quarterback? Or I'm curious why we haven't consistently ranked him in that mix. But yeah, if he's leading the league after 4 weeks. I mean, that's not a fluke. If we get maybe 8 weeks, let's get to half the season, especially if he's doing this week to week with Case Keenum as his as his quarterback, then that deserves a lot of credit, and he deserves to be taken seriously as a Pro Bowler, an All Pro type candidate. But yeah, now that you're putting a story into my head of, why is nobody paying attention to Stephon Diggs?
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing if you week one against the Saints, he has 93 yards. Okay, that's a nice game, but it's the Saints, and you had Sam Bradford. Week two with Keenum, 27 yards against the Steelers. You think, okay, well, this is what we're going to see with Case Keenum. And then 173 yards with Keenum against the Bucks, 98 yards last week against the Lions. Really, he would have got to 100 if Keenum. I think there was a play where he was wide open, and Keenum, like, underthrew him, and so he had to kind of fall down to make the catch and got touched on the ground before he can get up and run for a few more yards. So he would have had another 100-yard game. So I think he's been really impressive. I just think, like you said, it's about, is he going to have consistent quarterback play? Is the offensive line going to collapse? Because I think if the situation around him is good, he can be a franchise player. I think he can be a top 10 wide receiver in this league. Seems like we're both picking the Vikings to win this game, though, even though Trubisky may be more exciting, perhaps, than Mike Lennon.
Yeah, I'm not picking this as a super high-scoring game. I think I picked 19-14 in the paper. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to be a super high-scoring game from either team, but I think that the Vikings are the better team in basically every aspect.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I'm not as low on the Bears as some other people. I do think there's some promise there, but, yeah, I do think the Vikings are a really underrated team, a team that honestly should have beat the Lions last week and were a little unlucky in terms of fumbles. Let's finish up. Final game to cover this week, another team with a new quarterback. This one not by choice, Baltimore and Oakland, E.J. Manuel making his first start of the season for the Raiders in the stead of the injured Derek Carr. And I had forgotten a little bit about E.J. Manuel's most recent two starts. Just to remind people, his last start, he started week 17 for the Bills last year against the Jets, who were 31st in pass defense DVOA, second worst pass defense in the league in week 17. Nothing to play for either team. Manuel goes 9 of 20 for 86 yards. He's then benched for Cardale Jones. Previous start.
Yeah.
Previous start against the Jags in London. The Bills go down 27-3 before Manuel finally gets things going. They end up launching a furious comeback. Comes up narrowly short. They lose to the Jags. Bills fans spent most of this game yelling at me on Twitter because they were upset that I said Matt Castle being traded to the Cowboys was a good game, was a good trade for the Bills. He doesn't inspire a lot of confidence.
No, and yet all we're hearing out of Oakland this week is how happy the Raiders are to have him, mm-hmm. and how much more confident they are in their backup situation right now than they were last year when they had to start a playoff game with Connor Cook, who is now the number three quarterback there behind E.J. Manuel, Connor Cook never was in a competition at any point really this offseason to be the backup, which I think mm-hmm. says a lot about the deficiencies that he has and yeah. some of the struggles that he's having developmentally. I mean, when E.J. Manuel had to come in the second half, or I guess for the fourth quarter of the game against Denver last week, he looks pretty good. I mean, yeah. he moved the ball against the Broncos defense way better than the Raiders had in the first three quarters with Derek Carr. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how much of that was, you know, the Broncos defense changing up some of their coverages a little bit on him. Maybe they were a little relaxed because they thought they were in pretty good control of that game at that point. And how much of it is just the guy coming in with kind of a trimmed down playbook, no pressure, you know, kind of just flinging it around. And mm-hmm. I think we've seen that a lot from time to time. I mean, I remember like the last time that Derek Carr got hurt and they had to play a backup, you know, quarterback. You know, you've had some guys who come in without a lot of pressure and they look okay. I mean, Connor mm-hmm. Cook, I believe, came in the second half of that week 17 game last year against the Broncos when Matt McGloin got hurt. Yep. Connor Cook looked pretty good, but then when you actually spend a whole week having to go through a game plan and a defensive team can game plan for you, mm-hmm. it all fell apart. I mean, I think yeah. we've seen that from time to time with backup quarterbacks. I mean, Paxton Lynch looked pretty good for a half the first time he played last year in relief of Trevor Siemian, and then his first start really struggled. My bigger question with the Raiders right now is, after their last two games, losses at Washington and at Denver, is that their running game has completely disappeared. They've been mm-hmm. getting beat up front. Their offensive line, which is supposed to be their best unit on the team, has really struggled. Amari Cooper has not been playing well. Michael Crabtree looks like he's going to come back this week, but he hasn't had a ton of success. So this entire Raiders offense has been having some issues, regardless of who the quarterback is. That, you know, if E.J. Manuel is going to have a shot this week, they need to run the ball better, and they have not done that over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, it does seem like that has been kind of the surprise in that. If you think, okay, well, you know, the Raiders, are the one thing they're going to be able to do is run the football. And that has not been the case. And some of that's been blamed on Todd Downing, their new offensive coordinator who took over Fubel Musgrave. The story heading out of last week's game, and I could be mistaken, but it seemed like he told Derek Carr, from what I read, to not audible out of any plays, even if a box was loaded, to not like audible to a pass play if he saw eight guys in the box. So the Broncos just loaded up the box and were not concerned about stopping the Raiders' running game and did it with aplomb. I mean, they weren't even close to running the football at any point during that game. Marshawn Lynch is averaging 3.4 yards per carry this season. I mean, it's not been remotely functional in terms of Lynch after, I think, week one against Tennessee. And so the one thing I would say, and this might be the reason why I'm more confident in the Raiders winning this game than I would be against a typical team, is that I would be really concerned about the Ravens' run defense. They were gashed by Le'Veon Bell last week after Le'Veon Bell had been struggling all season. And it's not it's not just that they were playing the Steelers. It's that they're down two defensive linemen, one of whom is Brandon Williams, who's their best run defender, one of the best nose tackles in all of football, and then Brent Urban, who's a starting defensive end for them as well. So they were down a couple players, and they were beat up by a really good offensive line who was able to run the ball all game. So I could see a situation where, even though the Ravens know, okay, the Raiders are going to have to run the football, given the injuries, given that the offensive line you would figure is going to be good, you would think this might be a place where, even though the Ravens know they're going to run the football, the Raiders might actually be able to still do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think matchup-wise, running game, yeah, this should be a good matchup for the Raiders. I'm really curious to see if they're going to reevaluate their using Marshawn Lynch. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised to see when he wasn't being successful running between the tackles and with as many carries as they've been giving him, and they haven't been giving him that many carries, but
right. They
have. It's not like they've been using their other backs very much. They haven't been designing plays for, they haven't been using Jalen Richard very much. They haven't been doing very much, anything that's really creative with their backs, trying to get them, you know, involved in the passing game or getting them, you know, in different formations. It's just been very kind of boring. Like, let's see if Marshawn Lynch can run between the tackles and drag a couple guys for a couple yards, and then, you know, we'll get into second and long and third and long, and we'll, you know, throw the ball because play action isn't working. You know, Amari Cooper's having trouble getting open. So all of these levels of their offense aren't really working. And I think it's really now on, you know, their new offensive coordinator, Todd Downing, and to figure out some better ways to use Marshawn Lynch. And maybe that's limiting his snaps. Mm-hmm. Marshawn Lynch probably wouldn't be happy about that being on some sort of pitch count. But at some point, you have to look and say, this is not working, whether it's the blocking scheme, whether it's Marshawn Lynch's doesn't have as much left as they were hoping that he did, or they're just not using him correctly. Maybe he just needs to be a short yardage back or a goal line back, and you need to increase the amount of work that these other guys are getting. But until they fix that running game, it's hard to even pay attention really to what, you know, what EJ Manuel might be capable of doing here for a couple weeks.
Yeah, for sure. I think the flip side of this that might be positive for the Ravens is that, or for the Raiders, I should say, is that I don't know that the Ravens are especially well-equipped to really challenge Oakland. Yeah, it's still Oakland. I was going to say Las Vegas, but still Oakland. You know, when the Ravens are on offense, you think about their offense over the past few weeks, it's been terrible. And it's only getting worse given that they lost Marshall Yanda a couple weeks ago. Joe Flacco's numbers without Yanda have been terrible so far this season. He has a 68.2 passer rating and a 9.1 QBR with Yanda on the sidelines. Yeah, yikes is the word I would use for that. 91.3 passer rating, 52.4 QBR with Yanda on the field. So he's been a huge loss. And the way to attack the Raiders, if you look at what other teams have done, is they go after the cornerbacks, which is not has not done well for the Raiders so far this year. Sean Smith is a mess, has already been benched so far this year. David Emerson had a concussion last week. He's back in practice. He may not be able to play. It's not clear yet. He's just through the first stage of the concussion protocol. But Joe Flacco, 26.8 QBR in passes to wide receivers this year, 31st in the league, ahead of only DeShone Kizer. So I don't know that the Ravens are going to be able to attack Oakland's biggest weakness in this game.
Yeah, and that's disappointing, right? If you're the Ravens, where you look at, okay, this is a team if we have to go all the way across the country to play a road game, or, you know, we get a chance to get off the schneid to get a backup quarterback. But yeah, that's not a great matchup for them. And I think that the Raiders defense does certainly have some weaknesses. I think the Broncos showed some of their weaknesses in the run defense last week. The way that they were able to have success on the ground, their inside linebackers, I think, have been their weakness. Last year, they didn't really address it heading into this year. Mm-hmm. You're right, their cornerbacks have had some issues. But, yeah, the Ravens have been so frustrating to watch on offense over the last couple weeks. And I think we thought that they weren't going to be great on offense. Mm-hmm. Maybe we were a little more optimistic after the Jeremy Maclin addition, but they've just been so frustrating to watch. And, you know, given all of these questions that we've been talking about with the Raiders, I still think this is a game that the Raiders are going to win. The fact that it's in Oakland, I think that certainly works to the Raiders' advantage as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So are you taking Oakland then?
I am taking Oakland. I think they're going to score a decent amount of points because I'm not super high on the Ravens' defense right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to take the Raiders too, and I feel weird and a little worried about backing EJ Manuel, but I do think that the running game might get going this week. I do think the Ravens just have too many injuries. They're too beat up and down their roster on both offense and especially on the defensive side of the ball. So I could see a, like you said, a low scoring game where the Raiders are able to run the football and end up taking it.
Yeah. Although I guess if it were to come down to like a field goal competition, I think they've gotten rid of the dirt now in Oakland now that baseball's officially over. So if it is going to be one of those games where both teams are having trouble getting into the end zone, you know, maybe it's a Justin Tucker special. But I still have the Raiders winning this game, and I think they're going to win, and our whole staff is also in agreement on that game.
you're doubting Giorgio Tavecchio.
I mean, I love it. I think he's a lefty, which is also really fun. I think so. I should have double checked that before I said it, but he's got a fun story, right?
Yeah. I have no reason to doubt you. I have no reason to think that you're, that you're inaccurate in saying he's a lefty.
But I never kicked in the NFL, so what would I know?
He is left-footed. See, you did know. You did know. You don't have to kick in the NFL to find out whether someone is left-footed or not. Who could have gathered that? Lindsay, thank you so much for coming on the show and previewing this week. Where can people check out more of what you're working on a week-to-week basis?
So usatoday.com/sports. You can also follow me on Twitter at @ByLindsayHJones. I'm going to LA to write about the Rams-Seahawks this week, which I'm really looking forward to that game. Can't wait.
Yeah, me too. I will not be there, but I'll be watching on television, and I will definitely be sure to have you back on later on in the season to talk more NFL. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the Bill Barnwell Show. No show next Monday because of the holiday. We're going to come back at you later on in the week with a Tuesday show, then a show again later in the week, and of course, Nickel Package on Wednesday with me. Don't know who our guests are going to be yet for Nickel Package, but a couple intriguing ideas coming to mind as I think about it right now. But thanks so much for listening. Of course, subscribe, rate, review the show, all that good stuff. But either way, more show coming to you next week.